Voices of VR podcast. Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. I think training in virtuality is one of the killer apps. It's actually one of the things that was driving the innovation of virtuality since the inception, the very beginning. And then when it comes to using virtuality technologies to be able to train astronauts and flight simulators and military situations, it's something that has been a consistent thread throughout all of the history of virtuality. And one of the trends that I've seen at the last couple of VR conferences, whether it's at Oculus Connect 4 or the VR Strategy Conference or the Immersive Technology Conference, is that there's this move towards the enterprise and starting to discover the specific contexts and applications where virtual reality training is going to make a big impact. So Striver is a VR training company that's been focusing on elite athletes, specifically quarterbacks, both in college football as well as in the NFL. And so they've have all these different techniques to train all the different plays and teach the spatial memory. And essentially, they're able to tie together the process of being in the context, have your emotions engaged, and being able to make choices and take action. And all those things put together is how we learn. And they actually had some people from different corporate enterprises, including Walmart, to see their system. And they were like, you know, actually, this is very applicable to what we need to be able to do, be able to train our employees how to have these different interpersonal and social skills. So Striver's been expanding out from sports and moving into the enterprise. And so I had a chance to catch up with Dr. Michael Casale. He's the chief science officer there. And I had all sorts of questions about what is it about virtuality that makes it such a compelling training platform, and how are they able to actually measure and track how well they're succeeding? So we'll be covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Michael happened on Thursday, October 26, 2017, at the Virtual Reality Strategy Conference in San Francisco, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
So I'm Michael Casale. I'm the Chief Science Officer at Striver. We're an immersive training company using things like virtual reality to train anything from sports athletes to enterprise employees.
Great. Yeah. So I think the last time we talked was at the Experiential Technology Conference 2016, and that you were at that point maybe a year or two in from using a lot of your training system to train quarterbacks in football. And now it sounds like, you know, over the last year or so, you're getting into expanding into other types of training and corporate training. Maybe you could sort of talk about the evolution of like how the football thing is going with training quarterbacks and elite athletes, and then how that sort of spun out and expanded into corporate training.
Yep, great question. And, you know, on the surface, they seem like two pretty disparate areas, two different kind of skill sets. But as we're learning, and as I kind of suspected, there's a lot of overlap. So, you know, in training athletes, it's often critical to get the right kinds of what I would call perceptual fidelity and even affective fidelity. So a lot of the things that you get out of what we're calling immersion is the fact that you're seeing the same thing in the real world. You're reacting to it in the same way. And that's kind of a seamless process. Traditionally, you would get trained kind of in parts and in pieces. Here, we're kind of giving you the whole thing. And that's going to be more translatable. And as we're finding out and as other studies have borne out, that's more translatable to the real world. Well, similar thing in the enterprise space. So when you think about training your employees, even if it's for something less cool than like a quarterback throwing for a touchdown, it's still important that, you know, you're kind of getting the same perceptual experience so that you know how to react. The decisions that we make and what we know about how the brain actually learns is that you get perceptual information in, the sensory information comes in, you're mapping that in your brain, and then you're making a decision. You're mapping that in your brain. And those two things get connected. And if you're getting kind of connections between things that aren't represented in the real world, you might learn in that like local training space, but that learning isn't necessarily going to apply. So that basic principle will apply to almost any of those types of learnings, whether it is in the football space or basketball space, or whether it's actually in the enterprise training space.
Oh, that's interesting. And Amy from Accenture was giving a talk yesterday and showed the cone of learning and how at the highest level you have like text and abstraction, and then as you go down with audio and video and then sort of interactive experiences, and then basically the more immersed you are, the more higher fidelity it is of an experience, and that I guess the more likely it is for you to remember it. From I guess the science perspective, how do you kind of think about that or quantify that sort of as the higher levels of fidelity of experience, why is that better for retention?
So that's just like basically depth of learning, or I would simply call depth of learning. So going back to kind of what we know about the neuroscience of learning, you're basically hitting on a lot of different elements of that learning environment. So if you take her example and you think about text, those are just simple words that are printed in a, not that they're always simple, but the simple words printed on a page that are going to evoke some area of the, say, the visual cortex. And you're going to learn to map that area of visual cortex to a decision. Okay, now you incorporate sound. So now you have the visual cortex activated. You have the auditory cortex activated, and you're going to map that decision. Okay, now you're going to bring in emotion and kind of affective fidelity. Well, now you're going to map all that. So basically what you're doing is you're creating a more robust experience so that when you see that thing in the real world, that perceptual thing that you're supposed to react to in a certain way, you're more likely to react to it because you're having all of these things kind of activated instead of just one kind of part of that system, of that learning system activated. So if it's just the visual area that's being activated, that's much less likely to evoke that same kind of like natural response in the real world than if you're getting the compendium of the sensory information through affect, through auditory, through touch, through all these things. So there's a good story why those slides that she showed actually translate and kind of coincide well with what we know about the neuroscience of learning.
Interesting, yeah. And just from what I've looked at from creating an experiential design framework for VR and then looking at AI, there's like this similar kind of mapping. And so I see it as like these different dimensions. So at the highest level, you have cognitive intelligence or mental presence. There's also a social presence and social intelligence that sort of maps between VR and AI. And then you sort of going down, I guess you have then manipulative intelligence or the ability to express agency and take action on decisions that you may have made. So you may be in your mind making a decision and taking action on those. And then you have the kind of an emotional layer, which I guess it starts to get into more and more into the subconscious or unconscious processing of like there's an emotional presence, but also emotional intelligence that you have. And at the bottom layer is like the most rich sensory experience. It's all of our senses that are coming in. And so it's our sense of embodied presence and environmental presence, but also our kind of perceptual intelligence. And so to me, like VR kind of activates all of those things. And I don't know from the neuroscience if you would have another way of saying that.
No, exactly. And just, kind of what I was alluding to before, that's exactly right. And so what we would kind of like colloquially call the richness of the experience is exactly what you just described. It's kind of like the concert of all these different areas producing that behavior. And so you're kind of getting a better type of learning because of the depth of learning, if that makes sense. That's at a very high level. And again, there's a lot of studies both in the behavioral literature and the neuroscience literature to back that up.
Great. And so it sounds like that you're starting to make headway into the enterprise market. And so maybe you could share a little bit about what you've been able to do in terms of the types of training and the stuff that your system can do.
Yeah, it's pretty varied, which is pretty cool. So when people first see this, especially like in the sports training, it was a pretty big leap for that first person. And this person was actually from Walmart that saw the things that we were doing in sports. And they decided that, hey, this is a lot like what I have to do to train my folks to be better at their jobs. And again, it's the repetition, it's the perceptual fidelity, it's being able to make decisions naturalistically and in real time. All that stuff is going to lead to a better training experience. But even all that aside, just engaging people in a different way about their learning. So currently, I don't know how much you know about like the traditional learning methods, but oftentimes they're in classroom settings, they're observational, so they're very passive. You don't get to make responses. You don't get to kind of manipulate that information as you're learning it. That active learning that we know is better. None of that stuff really occurs because it's not efficient. I'm sure people would love to do it that way. We'll enter VR. VR is able to give you all of that and then some in terms of the engagement. And so knowing that we have a better training experience for basically the same cost or even sometimes cheaper because it's less costly to put people in VR in that same environment than bringing them to the store individually, systematically. That takes up too much time. And again, it makes folks also feel invested. You mentioned agency. Like, that's a powerful thing. Being able to be in an experience and knowing that you're acting and you're kind of affecting that environment, your decisions are creating the way that environment's going to shake out. You can kind of learn better how your basically decision making is actually going to matter. And I think for a lot of these folks who are going through this training, they don't have agency. Again, they're kind of anonymized in these rooms. Putting them in that experience, knowing that they're actually kind of like the masters of their fate, at least for that little training experience, is a really powerful thing. So these organizations are recognizing that VR can be a way to do that. Now, VR is not always a solution, right? There's going to be things that are actually better in the 2D world or just not possible in VR. We're starting to broach a lot of not just the rote training, but more of kind of the complex people, social interaction training. And that's where I think VR is going to make the most impact, albeit it's got the most challenges associated with it. But the fact of the matter is, if you can start to make headway even in changing behavior about how people interact with one another, about being sensitive to things that are hard to describe in words, nevertheless, they're taught that way, that's going to be a much more powerful and, we think, effective experience. And so a lot of these companies are focused on making just better people, I guess, in general, for lack of a better word. If, as Orwellian as that sounds sometimes, there are certain things that we know, being a better listener, being a better social kind of interactor with your peers, being able to have difficult conversations with them in a more effective way. I mean, these are all things that happen at work, and we know things like retention, employee churn, those are affected by these kind of micro events socially that happen every day. So if we can start to kind of make headway in facilitating and kind of enhancing performance in that domain, that's really, I think, going to be a really special thing. Again, it's got the most challenges associated with it.
I'm curious to ask you, because you come from like a neuroscience and learning background, it's from an academic perspective where things are very separated in a certain way. And it sounds like VR in some ways is this holistic medium that's able to kind of combine things together in a new way that kind of transcends the sort of reductionistic way that you may have previously been looking at it, but it offers you as a scientist new ways to kind of tie it all together.
Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't actually thought about it in the way that you just articulated it, but yeah, for sure, the academic world, almost by nature and because it kind of has to be, is reductionistic. To be able to systematically understand and test hypotheses, you kind of need to modularize it to some extent. To your point about then being able to kind of bring it all together in these kind of more naturalistic environments in VR, there's a lot of power in that too. So our co-founder is actually a guy named Jeremy Bailenson, who runs the Stanford Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And for years, he's been trying to understand social behavior through the medium of VR, because we know in the lab, to your exact point, even with social behavior, you're still kind of taking this reductionistic approach, right? Well, what about this social phenomenon? The VR environment allows you to manipulate all those variables efficiently and effectively, so you don't have to actually replicate that over years in studies. You can do it over a series of weeks, you know, in virtual reality by just being able to manipulate the CG environment and seeing how people react. It's an extremely powerful tool just for social behavior, but I'm sure for all kind of other fields of study.
Well, I think one of the other things that I've seen emerging is right now you have a split between the objective data that you can measure, and then there's the direct first person perspective of the person going through that experience. And so what I see is this thing called neurophenomenology, which is to be able to look at the correlates of the neurology that are happening, but you're actually trying to correlate someone's first person perspective with the third person sort of objective data. Is neurophenomenology something that you've been looking into in terms of how do you combine somebody's first person perspective with the data that you're able to capture?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I think if you really want to get more certainty around it, looking kind of objectively at kind of what the brain is producing in terms of its kind of like physiology and then how that correlates with these subjective experiences is the way to go. I know Jeremy's kind of done some of that work, at least with kind of like more basic cognition like learning and memory, but things like did they enjoy it, were they engaged, I think that's ultimately the way to go. Obviously the problem with a lot of these neuroscience techniques, while they're non-invasive and they're getting better all the time, it's still not trivial to put people, you know, through like a scanner, an fMRI scanner, or even put an EEG set of electrodes on their heads. That said, I still think there's a lot of power in doing just the behavioral correlate. So while it's probably more desirable to have that neural correlate, looking at just their objective behavior, how they responded, how they reacted, while it's a little bit more of a gross measure than the neuroscience provides us, it's still a good objective measure. So we can actually look and see, hey, maybe some of these behavioral measures that we're collecting that are objective, their performance on a task, how they actually like interact with the environment, which is very objective, which is something that's very unique to VR, by the way. Seeing that a learner is sitting in a classroom is often the assumption that they're learning, but now we get to see individual differences and like, hey, are they more engaged? Are they exploring the environment? Are they interacting with the environment more? Those are really objective behavioral measures that I think are sufficient enough to tell you something about them and their subjective experience. So we are looking at correlating how they're performing in the VR space behaviorally and looking at their subjective qualitative experience as kind of a validation of like, hey, yeah, they were more engaged. And of course, we know a more engaged learner is going to be a better learner ultimately.
Yeah, I think part of the challenge is that because there's like a level of cognitive awareness and then maybe like even the level of your behaviors and the way that your action may be starting to get below the level of conscious awareness. And so you're making behaviors, you're having emotions and you're having sensory input, but yet all of that is happening at an unconscious dimension that you may not be able to actually articulate. And so maybe some people made decisions before they're able to kind of make a story about why they're doing something. And so I just see that, you know, as a research scientist looking at this and looking at these human behaviors, you have the challenge of being able to try to quantify this sort of holistic experience and try to figure out what's going on. And that, you know, just looking at the challenges with presence research is that, you know, the fact that somebody's reporting about something after the fact, it's sort of like they have to recount something that's a part of their sensory experience, but then whenever you have to articulate something into words, there's some sort of information loss that happens there. And so they've sort of found that those surveys aren't necessarily always useful in the sense that they are giving you a number, but you can't add those numbers across multiple people to say, okay, generally this is the experience of presence, because everybody is going to have a different way of kind of quantifying their degree of presence. And so it seems like there's larger issues as you, as a research scientist, of like trying to take all of these kind of mix of objective and subjective, quantitative and qualitative experiences, and then try to like measure like how do you know what you're doing is working.
It's a great point. So there's a lot of things to unpack in what you just said, and they're all very important and nuanced points. And so the first thing you mentioned about kind of the lack of basically what we would call reliability in the subjective data, meaning that people are using the, like if you give them a scale to rate themselves in engagement, they're going to have different associations with what those numbers mean, or even their definitions of it. You can't just ask someone if they were engaged or not, because that's going to mean different things to different people. And then beyond that, if you try to get objective about it, typically looking at engagement means looking at the behavioral effort or output. And that means different things for different tasks. So there's really not a great unified way to be able to say from exactly to your point, one person to another, that when I see a 2 on an engagement survey, that that means the same thing for everyone, which really kind of renders it not very useful at the end of the day. Again, that's why, you know, VR has the power to kind of provide a level of insight and objectivity into things like engagement. That all said, the third issue, which is I think kind of what you're at least alluding to, is how do you really get ground truth for these objective metrics? It's difficult. And I don't know that anybody's really solved that problem yet. What you can hope to do is see trend. Like, so of course there's going to be noise and variability for all the reasons that we just discussed around like the subjective measures of engagement. The best thing you can do, and this is typically kind of in behavioral sciences, when you have these kind of like tough times getting ground truth or tough times figuring out like if there's just one measure, there's typically not. So ideally you have several measures or a handful of them kind of pointing all pointing in the same direction, and then you can feel a bit more confident. So it's kind of this converging evidence. As a research scientist, I never would look at one metric and say like even if you think you demonstrated reliability, validity, and even some association with some sort of behavior, I would never take that on its own. There's always going to be ways to pick that apart. You give me 6 and they all start to say the same thing and converge on the same conclusion, I feel a lot more confident about that. So for us, it's really going to be a challenge of like finding other ways to kind of measure that ground truth. And hopefully those all agree with each other. And then we can find if there's associations between those measures and these objective measures of engagement. Ultimately, if we are able to kind of validate that so that we have an objective measure that we know is a great indicator of something like engagement, for example, or like learning, then we can just use the objective measure because we know we have a lot more faith that that's reproducible. That's going to be the same thing. I actually wrote a paper on this. We have it published on our website. There's a bigger, more technical version coming out soon, but it's taking our existing data from, I think, thousands of users at this point, real-world users, going through one of our experiences and trying to measure their level of engagement with the experience. We did provide some validation, though, and the way we did that was with another behavioral measure. So not just asking them whether they were engaged, but if they quit the experience or not. So we allowed them to be able to say, no, I don't like this experience, or like, yeah, sure, I want to keep going. Those that made it to the end were able to basically showed more exploratory behavior. They showed kind of more volume of head movements. And again, these are things we can track with VR that you typically can't otherwise. So that to me gives me a lot more faith that that measure of engagement in that example is going to be indicative of some behavior that we care about, which is I don't want to do this anymore, or like, yeah, I want to keep doing it.
It reminds me of both YouTube and Netflix moving from like a 5-star system to like either a thumbs up, thumbs down. Because rather than trying to average out the stars across many people, it's more of a binary, like, did you like it or not? And that's a little bit easier to combine across multiple people. And it sounds like this sort of equivalent binary is like, did you shut it off or did you stop? And that is maybe a better signal than sort of having them try to, from a scale of 1 to 7, rate their level of engagement.
Yeah, and I think it's something we care about. I can't speak for the big production companies. I'm sure they have great, huge research teams on this. But if a movie got 3.5 stars versus 4 stars, I don't know what that means. Maybe they do, but it seems like that's kind of a difference that, to your exact point, could be attributed just to noise and how people are using the surveys. For us, it's a meaningful construct. Hey, they want to do this experience or not. As an organization who's interested in getting people to use VR, like, yeah, I actually care about that. So being able to tie it back to like something not only behavioral and objective, but also like something that means something to me, and that like logically makes sense, something I care about, is critical. So we were fortunately able to get that. And the fact of the matter is we created an experience where, you know, a decent amount of the people didn't want to do it. If we found that everybody wanted to do it, then it's not very useful, because then you can't really make that dissociation. But for whatever reason, they didn't like the VR, they didn't like the headset, it could have been the experience, whatever it was, we were able to kind of show that those quote-unquote quitters, which are about 20% of the people who went through the experience, showed a lower level of head movement. And that's, I think, a meaningful way to look at that behavior.
Yeah, and since you are starting to look at social dynamics and training people to essentially become better people in relation to other people in social situations, to me, it's really difficult to put any numbers on that type of thing. And it actually kind of goes back to this, you know, philosophy of science, which you may much more like, you know, transcendental idealism or phenomenology of like, what was your direct experience of this interaction? So asking people, again, there's all those other issues and challenges of having them sort of try to put words to something that was an experience. But I'm curious, how do you start to even wrap your mind around that process of like, I'm trying to train you to be a better person. How do I know if I'm succeeding or not?
It's a great question. I don't know that anybody's able to answer that right now. There's some great social science minds that have really dedicated themselves to understanding this issue. That said, it's really difficult. I think it's very context dependent at the point. It's really difficult to get systematic measures that say these three measures will apply to any social situation. Like I said, it's pretty context dependent, but we things are starting to emerge. So a lot of kind of the work in the nonverbal space. So the kind of way that you react to someone based on how they react to you. So averting your eye gaze when they try to make eye contact, kind of sitting in a kind of slouched posture, then kind of an attentive, forward, engaged posture. There's some systematic findings now that apply in a lot of different social situations that you can start to use. So again, this is why VR is great. It's the ability to capture that in a high fidelity way, and in a way that is used with a real world reproducible, kind of translatable social experience that allows us to capture this data and start to make assertions about, we know this isn't great. I would never go say like, hey, you should get this kind of training, or you're a 6 and not a 7. Like, we're far from that. I don't know if we'll ever actually get there. But the fact of the matter is that's a level of insight that is objective that you can use as a guide. And I think that's what all this is right now. These are kind of guides to be able to say, how is someone doing in training situation X, whether it's social behavior, whether it's identifying mistakes in the workplace, whatever the context is. And then say, hey, okay, this is where an area we know we could use more work on. And so it is relatively qualitative. But again, it's a level of insight we didn't know. Back to the example, when you have a bunch of learners in a room, you just assume that because they're in the room getting the same information, they're all learning at the same rate, they're all taking it in, they've all learned, right? But then you see the application of that learning in the real world, and there's going to be a lot of variance. Understanding kind of who's better, who's not, where supplemental training can take place. That's huge, and that's something that we don't really get from current training or even current diagnostics right now.
Well, it sounds like with VR, you're able to start to at least put people through a standardized like training regimen. And maybe there's some, you know, AI and interactivity at some point in order to really, you know, dial into the different interaction sort of branches that you may be doing. But just in terms of evaluation, it seems like, is it possible for somebody to be kind of an expert at body language as well as kind of their own depth of presence, of them being really present, having interactions with other people? And it's actually, from a phenomenological perspective, more about that expert's experience of this person and then being able to actually dial in and say, actually, this is what you're doing wrong. And it sort of gets into more of a human interaction at that point after they've gone through kind of like the standardized VR training.
That's a great point. And I don't have a great answer for that. I would say, though, that when I think about using these nonverbals as kind of diagnostic features, I don't also think of them as like the things to train, right? Although that mapping is typically like, you know, one-to-one. I think what's more like, we know that maybe this conversation isn't going well because you're kind of like not making eye contact. You're clearly like, your body language when I'm talking is, you know, kind of pulling away or whatever the phenomena is. I don't think that subsequent training then is to say, well, fix those behaviors and you'll fix the conversation. Maybe. But I think it's more that, okay, we understand that you're not good at paying attention. You're not good at attentive listening. Ideally, and what I think is going to happen is that body language is a result of you not being attentive. So being more attentive will necessarily just kind of engage the rest of the nonverbal. So by the nature of like the higher level social thing that you're getting better at or that you're correcting, the kind of nonverbal stuff will follow. So I look at those features as more diagnostic and less a thing to actually train and become expert on, I guess. But who knows? Like, you know, the whole world of embodied cognition says, well, maybe that's not true. Maybe if you're not smiling that much and I tell you to smile more, you'll actually be happy. And that's more the causal mechanism. There's a lot of interesting research going on in that space. So I wouldn't claim to know like what the necessary subsequent training would be. What we do know kind of is it from a diagnostic perspective, what kind of makes a good conversation, what makes a bad conversation, just based on your nonverbal.
And are you looking at any artificial intelligence interactive type of scenarios? Because I imagine that once you get dialed down into these social situations, it really becomes more of a interactive experience that has like a many more branches.
Yes, and that's really hard. And you mentioned branching, and that's about as AI as we're getting right now. We can accomplish a lot with just kind of intelligent branching right now. And again, this is, you know, these are kind of baby steps into this space, baby steps that are really helpful and create an awareness that wasn't there before. But there are going to be limitations, and there are for everyone these limitations about the ability to interact successfully with kind of like a virtual avatar, for example, so you can have that meaningful, realistic conversation. But again, because we can control the branching a lot better and we kind of constrain the nature of the conversation or even the social situation, we're going to be able to kind of provide a lot more of a robust experience, albeit limited in the sense that like it's not like a free form, like you can talk about anything with this person, but we don't want you to. We want you to interview them, or we want you to have this difficult conversation about firing Linda so these kind of very like specific examples. But obviously, you know, there's a lot of really smart folks working on kind of the AI problem in general. I know down at USC, they've done a lot of interesting work at the ICT there with being able to provide virtual therapy, where a therapist is able to kind of read your sentiments, read the words, and kind of use that information and provide some sort of intelligent real-time decision that's not like broken up. The decision tree kind of thing inherently kind of gets you in a little bit of a broken up dialogue, which isn't ideal but still useful. But the next level things are kind of emerging from those research labs. So I think it's coming. I also know how difficult those problems are. But that's the holy grail. Yep.
Well, and just looking at some of the experiences at both the USC ICT, but also University of Central Florida, they have these systems that are kind of like driven by the Wizard of Oz. So there's actually somebody behind the scenes listening and kind of driving the experience. And depending on what they're saying, since the natural language processing isn't really actually at the level perhaps in some of these scenarios, but at least there's like a standard branching that they can help guide and interact. Is that something that you're working on in terms of like having to drive the experience as a Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, we've explored that, and we've certainly, you know, in our kind of first foray, it's on the table. We do find obviously severe limitations to the scale of that. That's the obvious one. There is a company, an interesting company called Mergen, and I don't know if they solve this problem, but they do basically a really sophisticated kind of Wizard of Ozing where they're able to use a small bank of people in a kind of remote centralized way and then be able to produce a lot of the real-time adaptive reactions using humans, but humans who can substitute for any given avatar. So you want to make it, basically these people can wear the face of an infinite number of people depending on how you create the VR experience. There's a bank of them. I don't know how many, 20, 100. That's something I don't know. But they're able to then, again, reproduce hypothetically an infinite number of people. The problem is it's still kind of a one-to-one thing where you can't have one person who can be 10 different avatars at once. You can have them systematically become 10 or 100 avatars. So I don't know if that's a solution. It's working for them, I think, to some extent, and it's an interesting gambit. And so we're keeping an eye out. We're not wedded yet to any of these techniques at this point, but it's certainly something we're exploring. Obviously, if you can have something that's less adaptive and even foregoes the Wizard of Oz, but is able to be put in a corporate setting that the individuals at the corporation or the enterprise setting can use on their own as an adjunct to current training, and it's powerful enough to create that awareness and to create some of that kind of like better effective way to train these social concepts, that might be enough for us. So then while we lose a lot of the value of the maybe the Wizard of Ozing, we gain in scale and the ability to deploy and touch a lot greater number of people than, say, like what Mergent is able to do now. But we don't know. I mean, these are things that are a little bit TBD, but those are kind of the options in front of us.
Yeah, to me, I've been really excited about this concept of embodied cognition because to me it kind of represents a big philosophical shift in terms of moving towards these more holistic ways of thinking about how we think and beyond just our brains but with our entire bodies and actually also the environment. I'm curious to hear from you, like, you know, how do you think of the concept of embodied cognition and how are you specifically applying it as Driver?
Yeah, so we've just broached this. I've started working with some of our folks, especially in like these social settings, and the conversation we just had about, you know, is it really just changing the result behaviors that will then change the attitudes and the cognition, or is it really changing the attitudes and cognition that will change the result behaviors? That's kind of the crux of embodied cognition, is like actually changing the physical thing that you're doing will result in the change in the cognition, that the causal mechanism, the thing that you mentioned, the kind of unconscious behavior, that's happened. Our consciousness is actually then just kind of like coming up with a quick story about why we did something or how we did something. So like you forcing yourself to smile will then make you happy, and then you'll maybe make up a story about why you're happy, but it was actually the physical act of you just smiling that actually created that. And that's kind of the crux of embodied cognition. I think there's a lot of power for that in VR, and you know, we're not necessarily applying it in any of our things directly as like an explicit kind of construct, but I mean, if you think about a learner sitting there passively listening to someone versus a learner then actively engaged, that physical movement that's being facilitated by the VR experience actually may lead to a better learning. Again, it's the physical thing that's changing the cognitive state that's at the heart of embodied cognition. And our ability to do that, or anybody's ability to do that, frankly, with VR, is something that I think we're doing even implicitly, but making that more explicit part of our experiences is probably something we're going to explore in the near future. So,
I just wanted to follow up on that point around the subconscious sort of making decision in your mind sort of after the fact. I think a number of people have looked at that and said, oh, we don't have free will because we've already kind of made the decision. And so I'm curious to hear your perspective on that. I personally believe that we have desire and will and that we're able to actually exert our will. And maybe it's a matter of we have to cultivate new habits in our body through a holistic practice of repetition and that we're able to actually learn in that way. But in terms of learning and agency, what do you think about these people that look at some of that data and say, and they come to the conclusion that we don't have free will?
Well, this is an interesting, very deep and sometimes dangerous conversation. I don't know is my short answer. But I think as a practitioner of neuroscience, which, you know, I was more deeply at a previous point in my life, you do kind of have this at least tacit assumption that if you think about the hardware that's controlling behavior, which is the central nervous system, and maybe even you think about all the peripheral nervous system stuff, again, kind of with that embodied cognition phenomena, but just say that our nervous system is really the thing that's ultimately in control of our cognitive state. Well, those set of interactions physiologically are pretty well defined at this point. Just like a heart beats, there's neurochemical interactions that happen. Cells fire, cells respond, they get chemicals, there's action potentials. All these things happen in a certain pattern that produce the observable behavior. In the case of the heart, it's a heart pumping. In the case of the brain, it's a memory, it's a thought, it's an emotion. And so hypothetically, if you can reduce back all of these cognitive states that are really hard to touch and really hard to feel to the physiology exclusively, I think that the strong implication there is like, well, where does that leave free will? Or at least if there is free will, where does it exist? Maybe it's something outside of the physiology, which I think, you know, again, being a scientist, you have to be open to all these hypotheses and at least if they're testable. And maybe we'll get to the point where the techniques and the engineering and the ability to detect kind of like these physiological states are sophisticated enough that we'll find out something else about how free will actually works. Because it certainly feels that way. And some people think it's a byproduct of conscious behavior. I think that's a valid argument. I think it needs to be tested. So I guess my short answer is I don't know, but it's something worth exploring.
Yeah. It's something that I have a visceral direct experience, but I don't know if I'm being tricked and it's an illusion. And so I've been having these discussions with people, and I don't know either. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. And obviously it's something I've been thinking about for a very long time. There's some great reading. I don't know if you ever read like David Chalmers' books or like even some of like Steven Pinker's books or Dawkins, but kind of like start to not directly broach these subjects, but certainly have implications for that matter.
Cool. For Striver, what are some of the biggest open questions that are driving your work forward?
I think just kind of getting like a strong connection between what we're doing on the training front and how that's affecting real world behavior. If you think about the ultimate behaviors we think we're trying to affect, Striver is a part of that, but it's a part of it, right? It's not the whole entire thing. So when you look at someone's ultimate behavior that you're hoping to change, whether it's becoming a better person that interacts with people socially, whether it's you're better at, you know, doing your job, if it's like you're faster at loading the FedEx or whatever the application is, that's affected by a lot of things, right? So Striver training is going to help. But if you're like a FedEx worker and you're loading boxes and you happen to be really tired or you're going through a divorce, like those are things that are going to affect your job performance. Ultimately, quarterback, it's the same thing. Your offensive line decided not to block that day. Well, Striver's not helping with that. Striver's just working on your kind of cognitive components of your performance. And so it's really being able to ferret out how Striver performance does affect that ultimate kind of like real world performance that everybody cares about. While I think there's some fundamental limitations in being able to do that, as I just articulated, because it's, you know, made up of so many other things that happened in that person's life, there are some really cool things we can start to do to assess real-world performance just within VR. Again, if you buy this assumption, and I think that's kind of a lot of, you know, what our work is predicated on, that we're providing you with that real-world environment, and we can control that environment, to your point about kind of the research potential of VR, we should be able to know how you're going to perform if everything else is kind of like well and situated and controlled for. VR should be a good way to analyze how our training is affecting performance. So not only providing training in VR, but also assessing them in these real world naturalistic ways. And again, something you couldn't do before, but always better is the real world thing. So we hope to get there, but we also know how difficult that can be.
Great. And finally, what do you think is kind of the ultimate potential of virtual reality and what it might be able to enable?
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw a pretty cool thing yesterday. I don't know if you saw the Neurable guys, but that's the path, right? Is to be able to basically interact seamlessly in a virtual environment as you would in a real world environment, but you get to control the virtual environment in any way you want, to be able to kind of have a situation where everything in the real world and more is possible in the virtual world. And, you know, again, you can think of some really sinister applications for that. You can think of some really benign applications for that. So, you know, as Striver specifically, I think we're generating so much interesting data about how we're changing behavior just with our small foray into this space, how VR can really affect that, and what are the parameters that you should be building VR to really effectively reproduce that change in behavior from one application to the next. But yeah, but for you ultimately, I don't think it's going to be like the headset, but what we're calling virtual realities is the idea that you can perfectly simulate, right, this world, and that you can start to manipulate it in ways that are hopefully desirable, at least for most of the people in society, not just the hands of a few. But yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
So that was Dr. Michael Casali. He's the Chief Science Officer of Striver. So I have a number of different takeaways about this interview. Is that, first of all, the overwhelming takeaway that I have from this is just that VR is this ultimate training platform that is able to allow you to enter into the context and be able to tie together all the different systems in a way that actually is better aligned to how we actually learn. And I think the principles of embodied cognition is kind of inverting the causal loop that we tend to think about when we think about how we actually learn about things. Usually we just think about, okay, we're going to get the concept, we're going to learn it, we're going to hear about it, and then we're going to actually do it. But actually that may be switched in the way that you may actually have to be performing and doing the actions. And once you do the actions, then it's that process of doing that actions that you really start to put it into your body and you actually learn it. It's that metaphor of if you're smiling, then you may not be happy, but then it may be the physical act of smiling that causes you to be happy. The way that Michael phrased it is changing the resultant behaviors the thing that actually changes the attitudes and the cognition, or is it changing attitude and cognition that changes the result and behaviors? And so you're kind of starting with the result and behaviors, and then what emerges is that your attitudes and cognition is changing. And I think that the takeaway here is that the body is a holistic system, and you are able to put somebody into an environment where you're able to make choices and take action, have all of their emotions engaged, and the more depth of experience that you're able to create within a virtual reality experience, then the more likely is that whatever you're teaching them is going to have higher retention. They're just going to have it in their body, and it's going to be deeper memories because they're just going to have the experience. The problem, of course, is being able to actually measure and prove that. And I think that that's where a lot of those open questions are, that I think Michael is on the leading edge of trying to figure a lot of that stuff out. It was interesting to hear that in terms of engagement is one of the biggest predictors in terms of how you're going to actually learn something. And rather than doing a survey, because our subjectivity is very unreliable, we don't really know why we're doing things. We have all sorts of habits and behaviors and emotions and our perceptual systems. All these things are below our conscious level of awareness, that we're kind of like these zombies in some sense. We're going around and we're doing things that we don't actually have a logical or rational reason for. We're just kind of almost acting out of habit. And so taking surveys after the fact and trying to have people describe their direct experience has been traditionally pretty unreliable in terms of, you know, translating that qualitative phenomenological direct experience into numbers that can generalize out into some sort of objective data. And I think that's where neurophenomenology is trying to, in some ways, close that gap. I think it's a big open question of how can you actually validate someone's direct experience in the moment and also have these third-party objective data that are correlating to that and being able to actually have many different indicators. And that was the thing that I heard from Michael, is that in terms of trying to determine a causal loop, then he's looking at reliability, validity, and an association with specific behaviors, but there's always ways to pick it apart, and you actually need many different indicators to be able to see what is actually happening. So one of the most predictive indicators that they found was whether or not someone stops and says, you know, I'm done. And that's like a binary decision that they're saying, okay, well, at some point they kind of checked out, they weren't engaged. And then they're able, from that point, look at all the other behaviors, like what is the volume of degree to which that they're actually looking around and participating within the experience. And so then they're able to differentiate between the people who quit and people who didn't quit, and to be able to determine some of those other higher order ways of seeing, like, okay, what are the types of behavior that are really going to predict whether or not this is super effective or not. But at the end of the day, it's still the problem of when you're dealing with human behavior, how do you actually measure how you are improving? And this is largely an open question, as far as I can tell from this discussion from Michael. And that's what a lot of the social research scientists like Jeremy Balanson at the Virtual Human Research Lab at Stanford University, he's in the process of using virtual reality to be able to control all these different social dimensions and be able to see how people behave in these virtual environments, and then perhaps do a level of social science research that is able to increase the amount of rigor and insight that we have about the dynamics of human behavior. In that evaluating how people are doing within different social situations are extremely context dependent, but they're able to come up with some things like either body language as a measure of social success, or someone's averting eye gaze, or if they're slouched, or if they're attentive and leading forward, all these sort of subtle cues that you get in terms of how people are actually performing in these environments. Then they're starting to come up with some of those higher order ways of being able to teach and judge different social skills. So I have a number of different interviews that I've done over the last couple of months about training and training in the enterprise that I'll be diving in as well. But I think, you know, this interview with Michael is kind of really diving deep into the science and the neuroscience of everything. And I think there's a lot of progress that's being made, but also still a lot of open questions for how all this is going to play out. But I see that VR training is going to be one of those areas where there's going to be a huge uptake in terms of VR and immersive technologies. And I think specifically the standalone VR headsets, I think, are going to have a specific use case when it comes to training in the enterprise. I'm going to talk to different people about some of the challenges of using VR in the enterprise. One of them is deployment of the Gear VR or the Daydream being 3D off and not quite as immersive as they need to be able to do some of these training situations with 6 degree of freedom. positional tracking of the head, as well as the hand track controllers, and that the high-end PCs and all the other wires and logistics of that tend to also be a huge barrier as well, depending on the different industries. But to be able to mass deploy some of these standalone VR headsets, I think a lot of people in the enterprise market are excited to see what's possible when it comes to training, when it becomes a little bit easier to distribute some of this technology. So finally, the last thought, just the idea about free will. It's an open question. It's a philosophical question. It's a deep question that I think that nobody really has a clear answer to. One person that I really enjoyed talking about this is Seth Lloyd, who has this article and video on YouTube about a Turing test for free will. And he's making the argument that free will is kind of like the halting problem. The halting problem being this, you know, kind of theoretical computer science problem, saying that, like, as any computer program, if you ask it whether or not a program as it runs, is it going to halt or not, and if you kind of self-referentially feed that program within itself, then you have this sort of paradox where it can't even actually answer that question as to whether or not it's going to have enough computer resources or if it's going to be able to halt or not. And so free will could be modeled in terms of a halting problem, just not knowing and be able to predict what behavior is going to happen. Our mind is kind of like that, in that there's so much of our actions that are coming out of behaviors. But I think at the same time, what Dr. Casale was saying is that consciousness is kind of like the wild card here, in terms of, like, some people are theorizing that maybe that free will is contained within that phenomenological or qualia of a direct experience of being able to exert will, even though they're not able to find any physical correlates to that action. Maybe it's coming from some other sort of non-local conscious field. And that, at this point, doesn't have any testable data to be able to falsify that theory. So at this point, it's still kind of an open philosophical question. So that's all that I have for today. I just wanted to thank you for listening to the Voices of VR podcast. And if you'd like to help out this podcast, there's a few things that you can do. First of all, just spread the word. Send out this podcast on social media. Send it to people. If there's anyone that you think will enjoy this episode, send it to them. And also consider becoming a member to the Patreon. I rely upon your gracious donations to continue to bring you this type of coverage. So please do become a member today at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.